Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for taking the time to come and to give me the opportunity to address you today. As Sam mentioned, I'm with ThoughtWorks Studios. I run the software division of ThoughtWorks, and I've spent probably the last 7 or 8 years of my career leading large software organizations. Can I just see by a show of hands, how many people in the room are responsible for leading teams or organizations of people who create software? Okay, good. So most people in the room. So what I want to do today is just spend a bit of time sharing with you some ideas and some thoughts around leadership that I have found very useful in my own career in leading software organizations, and that I hope you'll be able to take back to your own organizations and put into practice. So, the Agile movement has done, the Agile community really has done a pretty good job of defining software practices, engineering practices, and management practices, and defining what it means to run a good Agile project. And really what that's meant for a lot of us who are leaders in organizations is the big rule that's been laid out is don't micromanage. So no one ever really tells us as leaders what to do. They just tell us what not to do. Stay out of the details. Don't tell me what to do. Don't micromanage. And no one ever really talks about what to do. And so that's really what I want to talk about today is what is macro management? How do we macro manage in this agile environment? So I'll take it in three parts. First, I want to talk a little bit about agility and responsiveness and continuous delivery and why these things might be important to your organization. And then if these things are important, what are the kind of practices and the things that we need to do as leaders to bring about agility and responsiveness in our organizations? And what are the behaviors and the mindsets that we need to exhibit as leaders? How do we be agile? So I'll start just quickly with some data. And this is a study that was done by IBM late last year. They interviewed 1,500 CEOs from a variety of different global organizations about the challenges that they're facing in their business environments. And you can see here from the data, the overwhelming majority of these executives are saying that they're operating their businesses in an environment that's more volatile and more uncertain and more complex, where changes are just structurally larger and different than they've ever been before. There's just this environment of complexity for the majority of the world's organizations that are really making it difficult for leaders to manage. And, there's this book by a guy called Donald Searle called The Upside of Turbulence, where he talks about in this book how all of this turbulence, all this complexity and this volatility can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. On the one hand, it can be very good because it actually creates opportunity. Turbulence and change creates opportunities for windows of opportunity to try new things and to get ahead. And on the other hand, it creates danger. There's threats. There's always someone with a new startup coming somewhere that can take what used to be a very important piece of your business. And so agility really has these two sides to it. If you're achieving enterprise level agility, can be about exploiting these opportunities as they come and really getting ahead, or just surviving these dangers and these threats that come your way and just staying alive as an organization. Just a bit more data, and I won't data to death you here, but just this comes from an economist study, so late to early 2009. There's also an interview of a number of CEOs. And this shows really that agility is now a strategic issue, and 88% of executives say that organizational enterprise level agility is actually key to their ability to succeed in their marketplace. And a huge number, 50% actually said agility is a differentiator for them. Their ability to respond quickly to whatever's happening in the market, to launch new products, to thwart dangers is actually now a core differentiator for them. So agility is now a strategic issue, but businesses have many strategic issues. And so to understand whether or not agility is actually important for your organization, it's critical for you to understand what is the core of your business strategy. So, and there's only two choices. So is the core of your business strategy responsiveness? Is it about launching new products quickly, taking advantage of new opportunities, taking advantage of new windows, being able to move very quickly and adapt very quickly, like, say, an organization like Google? Or is your core of your strategy about efficiency? Is it about driving out costs and eliminating waste wherever possible, doing things as cheaply and as quickly as possible, like, for example, say, a Walmart? Now, it's not that it's not that organizations don't do both responsiveness and efficiency. It's just that you need to understand which of these is your strategy, because one of these is a goal and the other one is a constraint. It's not that Google doesn't need to be efficient in certain areas. It most certainly does. And it's not that Walmart doesn't need to be responsive in certain areas. It most certainly does. But you need to understand which one is your goal and which one is your constraint. And the reason why you need to understand this is because these two different strategies bring with them very different mindsets, very different cultures and behaviors and approaches to solving problems. And here's, I guess, what I think is a pretty great example of the difference between a responsiveness mindset and an efficiency mindset. And this was a story that was told actually by Pat Reed, who's a senior director at The Gap, at the Agile 2010 conference it is now. And this story is that in late 2008, Gap acquired a brand called Athleta, which is a high-end women's athletic gear. And they acquired Athleta, and they very quickly got it online and migrated it to the Gap.com platform and brought it into their kind of whole e-commerce property and got it going and were able to attract a significant number of consumers and actually ramp the sales up fairly quickly. And along the way, they started to get a lot of feedback from their consumers, from their users, saying, you know, we really like these clothes. We really like what you're creating, but we'd really like to be able to try them on. We want to actually be able to touch them and feel them and see how they look on. And at the time, there was no Athleta brick-and-mortar store. There was nowhere you could go to actually physically shop for Athleta brand apparel. And so, you know, the head of the Gap online went to the head of Gap corporate and said, hey, you know, we've got this feedback coming. We think we have something here. There's something interesting. There's a gap in this market for women's athletic gear. Athleta seems to be fitting into it, but our users want to try things on. Can we have a brick-and-mortar store? Can we just try this out? Can we pilot this concept? And the CEO of the corporate said, yeah, we can do that. It's going to be 12 to 14 months to get the store together, but we can definitely do it. And so, you know, and the Gap, online CEO said, you know, 12 to 14 months, these are not time frames that we even think in. We don't, you know, any of you who are working in the online space will know that, you know, 12 to 14 months is like, it could be 10 years from now. So basically the Gap online said, well, okay, do you mind if we just go ahead and try setting up a store ourselves? We can't wait 12 to 14 months. We need it now. And so they, you know, kind of agreed that that's what they would do. And so the Gap online team actually went about the task of setting up a brick-and-mortar store for the Athleta brand. And they did all kinds of things to make it happen very quickly. And they actually managed to get it up and running within about 4 months' time. So the store was open 4 months later. And in order to do that, they, of course, took a lot of shortcuts. They, you know, cut corners along the way. They didn't hook up to the corporate accounting system. They used QuickBooks instead. And they took all kinds of different shortcuts. But they were able to launch the store fairly quickly. And it was a great success. And they've actually now gone on to launch several more stores. And they have a plan to do, I think, 50 more by the end of, about 18 months' time. So the point here is obviously that, you know, the online people brought this responsiveness mindset. They just, you know, they get things done quickly. You know, we can't wait. We need to get feedback. We've gotten feedback. We need to act on that feedback. Let's take the next step. And their responsibility was to just do things very quickly. Whereas the brick and mortar people, quite rightly, were focused on building big efficient stores. And so they brought their own mindset of efficiency to this problem of we need to get the Athleta users the ability to try on clothes. And so they took very different approaches because of the very different mindset that they brought to their work, because that was what their organization required. And so the moral to the story is that we can't bring these big company mindsets to new problems and new opportunities anymore. We need to bring a smaller mindset, smaller company mindset, and kind of grow things from there. So I guess just quickly to kind of tie this in, we need to think for ourselves as IT leaders. This is another study that was done by MIT Sloan, and they do a lot of studies in this space, talking about what is the role of the IT leader within the next 3 years. So today, and then within the next 3 to 5 years' time. And so, you know, no surprise, you know, today, which was in December of 2010, you know, the role of IT is largely about building platforms to support the business and to help the business do what it needs to do. But overwhelmingly, the role is going to be shifting now to this place where the role of IT and the IT leadership is about generating revenue and about helping to bring about new business processes and designing new business processes. And so we need to ask ourselves as leaders, what skills do we need? What behaviors do we need to exhibit to be able to do revenue generation faster? And I guess the key questions really that we need to ask ourselves within our own organizations is what is our strategy? What is the core of our strategy? Are we responsive or are we efficient? And what areas do we need to be highly responsive? And those are the good areas to target for an agile initiative or for a more adaptive approach to software development. And I think this is one of the, this is what I said on the panel yesterday for those who were here, but this is probably the key reason why we see organizations failing in agile transformation is that they don't actually have a need, a pressing need to actually do something faster. And so tying the need to the transformation issue is absolutely critical. So you've heard the words continuous delivery said a few times. It was mentioned in the keynote to kick off the conference by Tom Grant. If you're not familiar with continuous delivery, don't worry. It's not terribly material for this topic. There's a talk tomorrow afternoon by my colleague Jez Humble where he'll talk a bit more about continuous delivery, and I highly recommend it to anybody. But for the purposes of this talk, you can just think of continuous delivery as a way to get software into the and get it into the hands of your users very, very quickly. So it's about quickly getting a feature or a new concept out there into the hands of a user and then engaging that user with it and taking feedback and then continuing to iterate your product basically through continuously adding features, drawing your users in, taking feedback, and using that feedback to help you steer and guide your roadmap and guide your feature development. So that kind of in a nutshell is continuous delivery. And continuous delivery can have a huge impact on an organization's ability to be responsive. So this is a chart which kind of illustrates with the kind of phases of adoption that we see organizations going through as they take on agile methods. And starting there on the left is what we call iterative development or continuous development. So this is where an organization starts to organize themselves into sprints, organizing their work in increments, take on iterations, probably have a backlog, probably do regular stand-up meetings. They basically organize themselves to do things iteratively. And this is what we kind of call the Agile 101 level of Agile adoption in an organization. And then level two comes once you start getting into continuous integration. And this is the bringing in of the engineering practice into the way that we approach our work. And the key checkpoint, really, to move from iterative development into continuous integration is really, are you doing testing? And the key checkpoint after that is, are you really doing testing? Are you doing automated functional testing? Do you have enough automated testing and enough of focus and an approach, a strong strength of approach and capability in your organization to do automated testing well? And I think that one of the things, we go into organizations all the time and talk about, are you doing continuous integration? Oh yeah, we're doing, 95% of our tests are passing, and well, how many tests do you have? Well, about 40. This is a beginning level of getting to a continuous integration, but you need to be doing just test infected in your organization. So a very heavy test driven development approach. In my own organization, we have something like 30,000 tests that get run hundreds of thousands of times a day. So every time something checks in, you're just continuously validating that the software is actually still working with that change. So the next step through from continuous integration is then about continuous deployment. So, okay, I've validated that once I've checked in software that everything is functionally complete. I've not broken anything from a functional perspective. But, of course, I also have all of these other requirements that are not necessarily, what in some organizations are called non-functional requirements or operational acceptance testing requirements, things like security and performance and monitoring and maintenance. So all of these other requirements, validating those basically through a pipelining type approach. So I have an initial check-in, which is a functional validation, and then a series of validations, security, performance, whatever they may be, that I also must send that software through, and then push it live automatically into the production environment or into the hands of the user. So continuous delivery is really about kind of the extension of these agile approaches and practices, the planning and the increments, the TDD and the continuous integration, right the way through to software being pushed live into the operational live production environment and into the hands of the users. And this, if you can do this very quickly with every check-in, this complete validation live into the production environment, you can achieve tremendous responsiveness inside your organization. And I guess the key thing to point out here is that as you move from left to right on this diagram, there's a significant amount of investment required to do this. So you've got to break down all the silos. So a lot of companies have business silos and dev silos and functional testing silos and operational silos, and we're all separated. And fortunately, we all have a customer silo, which separates us from our customers quite often. So there's an investment required to break these things down from an organizational perspective. You've got to establish a culture of sharing. You've got to build capability around engineering practices and good software development practice. So there's a significant investment required to get to the right-hand side of this diagram. And so, again, it's very important for you to weigh up, why are you doing this? And the only reason to do that is if you can actually achieve responsiveness. The further right you go will only make sense if you can go to the north of this diagram and really achieve as an organization a high degree of responsiveness. So the organizations that I see doing this very well are organizations, I said on the panel yesterday, who understand product management as a discipline, who understand how to respond. So there's a change happening in my market. Okay, that requires software change, but what are the other things that I need to do in my organization to be able to take advantage of that window opportunity or to thwart that danger as an entire organization? So the organization's ability to actually become responsive and really embrace these changes is absolutely paramount and is really what drives whether or not it makes sense for you to push down to the right-hand side on this diagram. So just one other quick thing I'll say about this. I mean, this is, we like to talk about levels of agility. And again, the number one reason why organizations fail to make agile transitions is because they fail to try the reason for the transition to the responsiveness agenda of the organization. So we kind of think of agility in sort of three levels. This comes from Jim Highsmith, who's one of my colleagues at ThoughtWorks. And so there's a kind of an operational level of agility, which is about, and most agile, good agile transitions, successful transitions start at this level. So this is where, at the project level, agile practices are taken on. Teams can really start to embrace them. And, you know, typically, honestly, in organizations that don't have a need for responsiveness, this is where you start seeing agile teams kind of bumping up against middle management. So the middle managers are driving to a different agenda. It's an efficiency agenda or nothing to do with responsiveness, but yet you have these really excited agile teams on the ground that are trying to go faster and do more. And you see this sort of tension forming inside the organization. So that's the operational level. On the far end of the spectrum is in the strategic level. So this is where the organization has a totally responsive mindset and is able to see changes coming in the market and see what they need to do to take advantage of those changes and turn and guide themselves completely. And I think there's very few organizations, there's some software organizations that I know of that have done a great job at the strategic level, really turning themselves into a responsive organization right the way through down to operational. And then there's, of course, this portfolio layer in the middle. And this is where typically the organization the IT people have kind of adopted agile ways of thinking and agile practices, probably in the PMO or kind of the senior level of the IT organization, but the bridge has not yet been made to strategic. And so the portfolio level is really where you have this opportunity to make the connection between your strategy of your business and things that are strategically important and what actually happens on the ground. It's the kind of the bridge of the two strategic and operational levels. So that's just a little bit about kind of the organizational objectives, responsiveness versus efficiency, and why agility might be important for your organization and what areas of your organization where it might be important. So assuming that it is important for your organization or for certain areas, now I want to talk a little bit more about what it is that we need to do as leaders to enable that. So I like to think of doing Agile as kind of the execution levers. So it's like we're basically making the links between what's the strategy of our organization and what are projects doing on the ground, whether it's Scrum or Kanban or XP or whatever approaches they're taking. We have these execution levers that we can use as leaders. And these are the four that I want to talk about today. And some of them I'm pleased were mentioned several times already in talks here in the conference in the last few days, so I'll kind of touch upon some points that others have made as well. So the first thing I want to talk about is quality. And most organizations that I have worked in have systems that look like this, systems that nobody will touch because they're afraid if they do touch it, they're going to break something in unknown and untold places, and they're not going to be able to put it back together again and get things working. And in most organizations, people think it's the developer's fault that this ended up like this. And so developers and the testers, leaders have nothing to do with quality. You know, I didn't write any of this code. I wasn't involved. It's the developer's fault. And I think this is the first, you know, if I can do one thing today, it's to disabuse you of that notion. Leaders can have a massive impact, both positive and negative, on the quality of the software that gets created in our organizations. You know, we had a recent example on a ThoughtWorks project where we measure toxicity, which is just a measure of the several measures together, actually, of the code base and the quality of the code base. And there was a spike in the toxicity, and that's a bad thing. And we actually were able to trace it back to a change in leadership in the organization. So there was something that the leadership did in the organization that changed the way people were approaching their jobs that resulted in poor quality software. And I think, you know, as leaders, the biggest thing, the biggest, you know, kind of false predicament that we get caught up in around quality is this notion of features versus gold plating. On the one hand, we always want more features. We always, if given the choice, we'd rather have more features. We can see features. We can see the value that they deliver. And, you know, on the other hand, we're always thinking, oh, developers are just moaning. They just want to gold plate this stuff. They, you know, take some time out to clean up technical debt. No, we don't have time. We need more features, features. We always, as leaders, choose features over what we perceive to be gold plating by developers. And I think this is probably the number one area where we cause a lot of problems within our organizations around quality. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of studies. Capers-Jones, Michael Ma have done studies for the last, you know, two decades now at least, which overwhelmingly show that everything, cost, scope, schedule, everything runs through quality. So there's really no shortcuts or no way around it. And this is, I guess, the kind of the ultimate picture of that. I don't know if people are familiar with this kind of work, chart, which talks about technical debt. So running along the bottom here, the dotted line, this is the ideal world for our projects. And we have an initial release, hopefully within a very short time frame of starting a development. And then, you know, we get it out there, and then we continue to add changes. And ideally, we add those changes in a very clean way. So we write tests for them. We don't copy code from over here to over there. We don't create branches that we never clean up. We add these in a very clean and well-factored way, ideally, as we go along. Unfortunately, what happens in most organizations is that we don't add them in a clean way. We're in a rush. We're in a hurry. We need to get things done. We create branches that we never merge back in. We write code that doesn't have tests or doesn't have clean tests that pass. We copy code. We fail to refactor things. And we actually end up on this top curve up here where the cost of change actually just continues to increase. It gets harder and harder to introduce change into our software, into our code base, because we've piled up technical debt that's made us slower and slower and slower as we go. And then, of course, what happens is, once we've piled up enough technical debt and start getting slower and slower to add changes, then our responsiveness actually goes down. The delivery speed, our ability to add things quickly, our ability to estimate how long it's going to take to add something to the code base actually decreases. And so the key pieces for here, for us here as leaders, is to really to pay attention to this, to actually understand how these practices actually affect each other. So, you know, in an agile software world, we do all these things. We set ourselves up to work in increments. We have stand-ups. We organize ourselves to take change and to adapt. And, you know, there's many, many things in all of these agile methodologies that tell us how to do that. Unfortunately, there's a whole other piece to it, which is about making software adaptive. So it doesn't matter how much we can adapt, how much change we can accept into our backlog as an organization, how good we are at, you know, queuing things up on the backlog, if we can't actually get the change into the software. And so the agile engineering practices, things like pair programming and refactoring and TDD and continuous integration, these practices are there to make software easy to change. And so we as leaders have to intellectually grasp this idea that you have these reinforcing practices, all of which lead to a changeable and adaptable system. So there's accepting change into the system, and there's actually getting that change into the software. And that's what we can do from a software quality perspective. So investing, understanding that alone is a very important piece of it, and then investing in the skills and the capabilities and the resources needed to actually be able to achieve that. These are huge contributions that we can make to our own organizations to ensure that our teams can actually create quality software. And I guess the other key piece of this is then around, and I think a lot of organizations that I visit certainly miss this, is the nature of software architecture and the importance of software architecture in building adaptable systems. So creating, if you want to release software in the small feature as you go, you need to have a software architecture and that actually allows you to make small changes and deploy small changes. And so understanding how those things work together. As leaders, no matter what our backgrounds, however technical or non-technical we perceive ourselves to be, we can understand these things and we can make decisions in our organization to positively influence the direction and the quality of the platforms that we build. So that's really all I wanted to say on quality. The second practice that I wanted to talk about that I think is key for us as leaders, you know, if responsiveness is our goal, if we really care about being adaptive and responding to changes in the market and doing things very quickly, we have to change what we measure. And you know, it seems very obvious sitting here now in 2011, but you know, we used to use this triangle on the bottom. This is Jim Highsmith's Agile Triangle. If you've read his Agile Project Management book, you may recognize it. You know, and it stands in stark contrast to the triangle down here in the corner. And, you know, it seems very obvious now that cost, scope, and schedule are not goals of a project. They're not things we wish to achieve. They are constraints. They're boundaries in which we must operate, but they themselves are not objectives. So if responsiveness is the objective of our organization and therefore of our software projects and our programs and products, then we need to reorient ourselves around value. We need to stop asking ourselves, have we implemented all the requirements? And start asking ourselves, can we release this product now? Is there something here that we can release? Can we release it now? And there's many studies, I'll talk about one in a minute, but you know, we're still, I think it's something like 50% of the software that we create is rarely or never used. So scope is a horrendous project control mechanism. We should all get rid of it immediately. We create way too much software. We need to orient ourselves around value. Is this ready? Minimum viable product. Can we release this? And of course, the key piece of that then is this other piece of the triangle, which is quality. Having an adaptive platform that on which we can release things very quickly and in a predictable and reliable way. So having an adaptive platform is in the third piece of this agile triangle. So that's what I want to say about, so I've talked about quality and speed to value. The other thing that I think is key, and this has been touched upon several times this week as well, is just around doing less. And you know, the mantra has always been in the past, do more with less. And you know, this is something now which actually Pat Reed, the woman that I spoke about at The Gap, senior director there, she's shortened this down to just do less. We need to do less. We still create way too much software relative to what our customers and our users actually want from us. This is some data. Again, this stuff is just a little bit old, but there's a more recent data, in fact, which shows that the numbers are even worse. We still create way too much software. We don't pay attention to what we're creating is actually getting used. And so there's obviously a whole lot of work going around in the analytics space and the agile space to try to understand the impact of the features that we create and whether or not we're actually getting uptake in the software that we're creating. So, you know, the question to ask ourselves is obviously what if we could eliminate, you know, even 15% of the 50% of features that we create. What else could we do with that time and with that investment? This is the traditional value curve for a traditional project, so everyone should be relatively familiar with this. We have some cost. At some point, we can potentially release our software, And at some point, we can actually regain we cover the costs that we've invested and actually then move into return on our investment. And obviously, one of the big promises of Agile is that we can get an earlier return on our investment. So we have software ready earlier. We can actually get into the hands of the user, and we can start recouping the investment earlier, and we can carry on developing and adding features. And so the big question for us to pay attention to, really, in this Agile world is, when do we stop? So where is the right cutoff point? Do we need to implement all the features? Or could we stop when we've delivered 90% of the features, 90% of the value, rather, at 70% of the cost? And how do we know that the next most valuable thing to work on isn't somewhere else, on another product or another project within our own organization? And so again, this is about reorienting yourself around value and paying attention to the value of what you're delivering and reallocating resources to reworking on the most valuable things. So doing less is not just about eliminating low value or marginal value features. It's also about just reducing the amount of context switching and whip that we have going on within our organization. So this is a pop quiz that my colleague Jim Highsmith likes to give. An engineer is working on 5 projects, and how long will it take her then to complete a 2-week effort task on any one of those projects? Is there anyone who knows the answer to this question? How long?
20.
48. So this is, I forget who the gentleman was earlier today, was talking a lot about Kanban and the ideas of, so he did a nice illustration of this. But the general, there's a lot of stuff we can learn here from the lean people around value stream mapping and eliminating the context switching and the multitasking, which, you know, if you're trying to do something that's really engaging you from a cognitive perspective, this stuff wastes a lot of time and effort in organizations. So obviously, we as leaders can have a great deal of control over. In fact, the person's talk that I was in, he said, how many people are working on 5 projects? And a bunch of people, how many people are working on more than 5? Even more people raise their hands. So this is definitely a pervasive problem in our industry. We have this idea that people can switch context and be immediately productive on something else without losing anything along the way. It's a huge problem in our industry. And we as leaders need to, you know, acknowledge that and need to stop it. The fourth practice, the thing we need to do as leaders that I wanted to talk about a little bit, was just around engaging and inspiring. In Dan Pink's book, I don't know how many people have read Drive. If you haven't, I recommend this book. And there's some good video on the web that kind of some excerpts of it. And this is an excerpt from one of the videos. He talks about how organizations, businesses, have really been ignoring the last 50 years of research about what motivates and what inspires people. And in the book, he talks about that human beings have this sort of innate needs that really can't be fulfilled by carrot and stick, by financial incentive and, you know, basic sort of rewards type mechanisms. And, you know, where anything that requires you to engage yourself cognitively, there's kind of 3 things that really drive us as human beings. And the first of these is autonomy. And people like to have control over what they do. They like to feel like, you know, they have some say in things. Self-informing teams, empowered teams, these types of things. So we as leaders obviously have a lot to say about the amount of autonomy that we give the people who work with us and around us. The second thing is mastery. People want to get better at what they do. I mean, the idea of just going to work and having a meaningful day and feeling like you're advancing in your own practice and getting better at something is actually something that's just really inspirational and motivational for us as human beings. And obviously, as leaders, we have a lot to do within our own organizations to make sure that we've created this kind of environment. And then the third thing is just really around purpose. Having something that's bigger than yourself that you're aspiring to do is something that motivates all of us. And so, you know, these are things that are entirely within our area of responsibility as leaders, creating a culture and an environment where people have autonomy and the ability to get better at what they do and to do what they do very well and to do it with a meaning and a purpose and a higher level goal. So those are the kind of four qualities: speed to value, doing less, and engaging and inspiring. Those are kind of the four key sort of levers that I think that, you know, I certainly have tried to keep front and center in my own leadership activities, and that I found very useful in guiding my own organization forward, and also helping to guide forward my clients' organizations. So the third thing that I want to talk about then is just the being part of Agile. So what are the behaviors and the mindsets that we need to instill and we need to exhibit and then instill in our own organizations to be able to achieve agility and responsiveness at a meaningful and strategic level? Dee Hock is probably one of the great adaptive and agile leaders, really, before any of us were talking about any of these things. He was the founder and CEO of Visa International in the 70s and 80s, and then went on to do a number of really wonderful things in the public sector. And he's kind of one of the original doers and thinkers in the sort of whole decentralized, flat, node networked organizations. And he talked a lot and always about the need to lay out clarity of purpose and vision. And if you spend a lot of time on vision and purpose and mission, you'll actually find that people will actually just start to do really smart things. They'll get it. If you set context and give a way for people to connect into that context, people will do great things. On the other hand, if you spend a lot of time telling them what to do and laying out the specific rules and giving them, you know, specifics on their behaviors and their requirements every day, they'll start to do really dumb things. And so he was a great inspiration in that regard. Another great example of an adaptive leader, and this example actually comes from Organizing Genius, which is still, I think it's published in like the late 90s, a guy called Warren Bennis, who's also a great thinker on adaptive organizations. I think still one of the best books, actually, on, you know, creating a really exciting workplace of discovery and emergence. But in this specific story, Warren Bennis relays how Walt Disney went to France in the late 1930s. And when he was visiting France, he saw in Paris that they were screening Mickey Mouse cartoons back-to-back in the theaters. So if you go to the theater, they would screen five or six Mickey Mouse to make sort of the illusion, really, of a full-length feature. And so when he saw this, he just became obsessed with this idea of making a full-length feature film. And so he came back to the U.S., and this is, remember, the time there's no, you know, digital computers and all that. This is, you know, people literally drawing by hand little pictures to create, you know, a 1.5-hour film. And so he became obsessed with this idea of this, which was at the time seemed impossible, very hard, if not impossible, I guess. And so most people don't know this, but he wasn't really a great animator. He wasn't a great artist himself. So he actually went out and recruited a whole bunch of artists and animators to come and join him. And I think in the end he recruited around 700 people overall, from animators to people doing music and whatever else. And so he came back to the States, he had this grand vision, and he went and recruited a bunch of people, some of the best animators in the world, and he got them all together in a room, and he just started acting out, line by line, scene by scene, every character himself, acting out the entire story of Snow White. He laid out the vision for this group of people. And then he actually was very hands-off in the making of the film. So he laid out the vision, and then he stepped away and made sure that he had the right people in the organization, that they had the right resources, and that they were able to create the wonderful work that later became Snow White. So, again, I think a very good example of a leader that focused on vision and bringing the right people together, creating an environment of discovery and learning, and you know, great results came out of that. So these are the four behaviors, really, that I want to spend just a little bit of time on today. The first of these is adapting. You know, most organizations say, you know, they accept the idea that change is good and that they need to be able to adapt, but very few of them actually put the mechanisms in place to be able to adapt. So adapting is a natural process. It can be goal-oriented, but you can't really control adaptation. It's a natural, it's already been decided how you need to guide, but you can't control it. And so adapting as a behavior and a mindset is really, it's not just about accepting the idea that there's going to be change and you need to adapt. It's also about understanding how change trickles through your organization, so understanding the adaptation process. If you look on the upper left here, this is our old friend, the Gantt chart. How many people still do planning using something like up in the left? It's funny, actually, I did this talk for a bunch of thought workers who are kind of early 20s, mid-20s, and they didn't even know what the thing on the upper left was, actually, which I thought was shocking. But the Gantt chart was actually helpful for us in planning large programs. But one of the challenges with this approach is that what happens is we end up with, you know, there's a business objective or a vision, presumably, behind some kind of software initiative. And then we break that down into tasks. And these tasks then kind of get buried in this Gantt chart. And it becomes quite difficult, really, to understand how they actually tie back to a business goal or a business objective. And so as the business objective changed at the top, it was difficult, if not impossible, to actually get that change into the plan, to see what you would actually need to do to be able to affect that change in whatever program or software initiative was going on. And so people focused on conforming to the plan because that was an easier thing to do. The plan was there. It made us feel safe. We knew what we needed to do, and we followed the plan. So it basically caused people to over-focus on conforming to the plan above and beyond focusing on whatever the organizational needs were or the business needs might be. And so obviously the contrast to that is this thing in the bottom right here. And this is an innovation that came from a guy called Jeff DeLuca, FDD, if anyone's familiar with that, which is one of the sort of original agile methods out there. And this is an FDD parking lot. And so the key innovation here, which then later fed into other agile methods, is this concept of orienting yourself around value as opposed to orienting yourself around tasks and things in a plan. So if you can organize yourself according to value, then obviously you can see very quickly as a business need changes, as a new objective or goal arises, it's very easy to see how to take that goal and then trickle that into a plan to understand which tasks are affected or not, what new things need to be there, using a more of a value-orientated approach. So there's lots of tools available for helping us to think about how we adapt as an organization. And these are just four, and there's 400 really. These are four that I like to use. The one on the top left there is the purpose alignment model, and this is just about understanding what's important for your organization. So what things are we doing that are differentiating us relative to our competitors? The upper right you may recognize as the OODA loop. So this is around fast decision making. Try something out, take the feedback. What happened? Make another decision. Try something else. Fake the feedback. What happened? The bottom left actually is something. This is something we see a lot of organizations using at the strategic level. This is called the short horizon model. You may recognize it as the way you do roadmaps on your projects. A lot of organizations are actually taking this kind of iterative approach now to strategy. So if you've not got the horizon of 12 months, which many of the organizations interviewed in the IBM study that I showed you in the very beginning don't have, you're doing your strategy in much smaller increments, months sometimes, certainly within quarters. And so using a more of a short horizon model for doing that sort of planning. And then the one there on the bottom right is the Satir change model, which is actually originally came from Virginia Satir, who's a family therapist. And so the whole idea there is just, as you change, things get worse before they get better. So these are just four models, and there's many tools out there to really help you. The point here is that, as leaders, it's our job to not just say, yeah, we're adaptive, we're going to change, but to actually understand how are we going to get this change through the organization and to make sure that we put the mechanisms in place to be able to do that. And tools like this can be very helpful for that. The next behavior that I wanted to talk about is exploring. And I think this is probably the key area for organizations who are transitioning from a more predictive or waterfall approach to an agile approach. This is probably the hardest mindset to break, I think. We get into this plan, do mindset. And it's very hard to get ourselves out of that. But we, as an adaptive leader, if you're trying to achieve some sort of agility or responsiveness in your organization, you've got to figure out how to develop, get comfortable with experimentation and discovery and emergence and not knowing everything up front. And that doesn't mean that you don't, it's not plan or don't plan. It doesn't mean that you don't plan. It means that you plan some and you do some and you take some feedback and see what happens, and then you plan some more and then you do some more and see what happens. And all of that within a context of a vision. So getting comfortable with this idea of emergence and exploration is absolutely critical if you're going to achieve agility at a strategic level. The almost last that I want to talk about is facilitating. Facilitating is really just a nice way of saying don't micromanage. So our job as leaders is not to tell people what to do and how to do it. It's to create an environment where we have the right people on the bus and they have the right resources to do what they need to do, and the obstacles are removed. You know, Jack Welch always used to say, I have three jobs. My jobs are to recruit the most awesome people I can into this company, get the best people, to make sure then that they have the funding that they need to get what they need to get done, and then to make sure that I cross-pollinate ideas as quickly as possible and share ideas as quickly as possible, good ideas across the department. So that's my three jobs. And Walt Disney used to talk about himself as a bee, kind of buzzing around the Disney studios and cross-pollinating and sharing ideas. And that's really our job. That's a big part of our job now as leaders in this adaptive and agile environment, is to take the best of ideas and make sure that those ideas make it in the organization. And I mean ideas about practice and approach and process, as well as business ideas. And I think this is the organizations that we see really getting ahead with achieving strategic level agility have really turned the whole concept of governance on their head. They've either gotten rid of the PMO entirely or completely changed the role of the PMO to be something that's more geared towards sharing best practice. And I think the key thing is, if governance in the kind of industrialized business management mode of thinking, if governance is about compliance and making sure that, everybody's adhering to a kind of a basic set of standards, you need to remember that with that, you're actually cutting out, you're definitely reducing your risk of encountering the lows, of people doing really bad things and things going very badly wrong. But you're also removing all possibility of any highs. And you're basically taking away, through standardization, you're saying, okay, I can get rid of that stuff. But you're also getting rid of just the really great things that make teams awesome, that excite people, and really make great things happen in a software environment. And so it's our job as leaders really to rethink how we approach governance in our organization, to bring a facilitative model to our governance, and to make sure that we're propagating best practice from or good practice. In fact, I think it was Tim Lister this morning, he said the best practice, and I agree, it's something we should abolish from our vocabulary. There is no best practice. There's practices that work well within a specific context that might work somewhere else. and to make sure that those practices are things that live on in the organization, and that we create a culture of sharing and continuous improvement. And then the last behavior that I want to talk about, this is a statue called Paradox. It's by a guy called Michael Baert. He's an artist based out of New Mexico. One of the big things that many of the big challenges and issues that face us as leaders in our organizations appear on the surface to be paradoxical. There's this, I think probably the biggest paradox we face, particularly in an agile environment, is this need to be predictive, to be able to predict when we're going to finish and predict how much we're serving, and to be able to adapt, so to accept change, but also have a pretty predictable idea of when we're going to get the software ready and get it done. And so we're living constantly in this world of paradoxes. Be predictable and adapt. Do Scrum, Kanban. So do we do Scrum? Do we Kanban? Do we do no upfront design? Do we do big upfront design? Do we do waterfall? Do we do agile? There's all these things facing us that appear on the surface to be very paradoxical and require us to choose, to or things. And, my statement to you is that we have to learn to be anders as leaders in this new adaptive world. So we need to be able to step back from these direct paradoxes, these things that seem to be so contradictory, and just accept that there are contradictions and that there are good things in all of these things. There's things that we can learn from Agile, from Scrum, from Kanban, from big design, from small design, and choose the best bits of each of these solutions and build inclusive solutions that actually take the best bits of each of those for the context and for the problem that we're facing today and in this context. And what we choose for one context may be not the right thing for another context, and we need to accept that. So this idea of just kind of riding these paradoxes out and really living with the the uncertainty that we have in a lot of our environments. And Tim Lister said this morning about, in most organizations, it's okay to be wrong, but it's not okay to be uncertain. And, we have to change that as leaders in ours. If you look at this guy here, he's kind of relaxed up there. He's got the courage to kind of just deal with the fact that he's not going to be able to know everything today. And there's some things that are going to be a little bit messy over here and a little bit cleaner over there. And that's just life. And that's in some ways the joys of software and leading a software organization. And so riding paradox is really a key behavior that we need to be able to exhibit for the people that we lead, but also for those who lead us and getting comfortable with this. And riding paradox really requires us to move beyond prescriptive rules. I think in a lot of organizations, particularly those that are just coming to Agile, get kind of caught up in this the rules of something. So one common sort of anti-pattern that I see is around Scrum certification. People go and get their Scrum certifications, and then they come and say, and these are the rules of Scrum, and we must do our task board like this, and we must have our sprints must be exactly this length, that's fine, because it's actually a good on-ramp. It's good to understand the rules. The rules give us a basis and a foundation for understanding. So it's fine. It's a natural on-ramp into Agile adoption. And, rules can help us with that. And certainly Picasso understood the rules very well when he painted this picture here on the left. But it wasn't really until he started breaking the rules that he was able to start creating some of his best and most beautiful work, like this picture here on the right and many that came after it. So, beautiful things can come when we understand the rules, but also then we understand them so deeply that we know how to break them and where to break them so that we can create something truly unique and special within our own organizations. So that was really all the prepared material I had today. The kind of recap here is just, if there's one takeaway, it's, connecting your goals around agility and responsiveness and to your strategy, to your business strategy for responsiveness and efficiency is probably the key and most important thing. And then, recognizing that we as leaders do have a big role to play in achieving this level of agility, in sort of making the connection between our business strategy and what happens in our software teams through these things like quality and speed to value and doing less and engaging and inspiring people, creating organizations that adapt, exploring, facilitating, and I think in some ways most importantly writing paradox and learning to become anders in our profession as opposed to orers. So thank you very much. I don't know if there's any questions at all. Or
we have time if anyone has questions for Cindy.
End of the day.
You made a comment about project managers' roles in, being agile and that. How do you see that changing going forward?
A project manager's role?
Yeah.
Specifically? Well, I mean, I still think, so when I'm talking about leadership here, I'm talking about, if you're not directly involved in the software initiative. So, I mean, project managers are the same, to me, it's around helping the teams creating a platform for the teams to self-organize, to understand what's important, and then removing obstacles, really, just getting things out of the way so that teams can actually, get on with it and get things done. I think every organization has a different take on, what project management is, and I think that's totally fine, whatever makes sense for that organization. But the probably the number one thing, the big number one shift, really, between in an agile environment versus not is this your role being about removing things out of the way, making sure that the teams have what they need to be able to get on with it and be productive. Yeah, hi.
So, given the idea of reducing WIP and that we've got most companies have what I would call a project-centric mentality rather than a product-centric mm-hmm. mentality,
yeah.
Have you found things as you've sold software and consulted, et cetera, that help organizations change from thinking in a project mode to a product mode?
It's a really tough one. It's a hugely important leap that that we all are going to have to make, and it's a challenge. I think the key things the establishment of product management as a proper discipline within an organization is probably the number one thing that I see in organizations that are able to achieve this type of responsiveness. And product management, as you may well know, is in itself, there are many different takes on what that actually is. I think there's a great kind of consolidation happening in our industry around thinking and product management. So some of the great books are, if anyone is familiar with Stephen Blank, I think he's kind of one of the first to really consolidate. His book is a little bit difficult to read, but it's probably, it's definitely my Bible as far as establishing product management as a discipline in my own organization, and certainly something I recommend to my clients. The lean startup folks have some really interesting stuff. If you haven't read Eric Ries's book, it's basically built on top of Stephen Blank. Obviously, Jeffrey Moore has his Escape Velocity book out, which talks about that. Marty Kagan has a good book on Inspired. So really, honestly, taking on this, let me understand product management and what this is and what it's going to mean in my organization, taking time to bring in, hire people in. There's a lot of talent already out there that's been in a software vendor world that may fit within an enterprise context. There's a lot of, I've spent a lot of time really bringing outside experts into my organization and helping us to kind of raise our bar and our understanding of it. So honestly, I think it's something we have to, everyone's going to get there. It's just who's going to get there. I mean, whether or not you're going to get there before your competitors do. There's some large enterprise organizations who have, I wouldn't say they've cracked it, but who have gotten very, very good at a product management discipline in their organization. And what you find is actually a lot of these things that I talk about here around continuous delivery, they actually go away because a good product manager gets the need for an adaptive product. And then, it's quite a no-brainer to be able to change my product quickly. Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Okay, I believe you. Here's some space to actually, clean up the debt and make it, make it more adaptive. So I think it's, we're only at the beginning of it, but really in the last 2 years, there's been a consolidation and kind of a rising up, really, of good product discipline. There's product meetups in pretty much every city, probably most of the cities in the world that we all work in anyway, that, where you can go and learn from some of the greats, really, in the industry around product management. So highly recommended to get your organization infected with it. Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of organizations doing it.
Can you repeat that?
The question was, how do you actually take care of this technical debt? So, okay, say I'm one of those leaders that doesn't want it. How do I stop it from happening, or how do I make sure it gets cleaned up? It's funny, actually, that there's a great blog post that Jim Highsmith just published about called Velocity is Killing Agility. How many people measure velocity in your organization or are familiar with the concept of velocity? So velocity is kind of it's a capacity measure for how much stuff you get done. And unfortunately, what's happened in most organizations is velocity has become a productivity measure. And so we target teams on getting lots of stuff done. And we just ignore the fact that in getting stuff done, they're actually writing really crappy code and doing really stupid things and creating a lot of technical debt. And so you're actually killing this notion of agility and being able to change things quickly in this quest or this pursuit for velocity. And so one of the ways that I see organization talent, the way we handle it in my own organization, is we actually have technical tasks. So we budget, features, and we budget room for technical tasks, and you reserve a percentage of your backlog for any given iteration or period of time to actually do cleanup. And, obviously it's not for us as leaders to decide what actually gets done in that space. We have, the tech leads or the team themselves who understand better what that is. But to just say, okay, I'm gonna trust you, that you're not gold plating, that there is stuff here that you need to clean up, and I'm going to give you, 40% of this iteration, or, some companies choose to say, okay, every fourth iteration is, clean up. So it allocating space and tasks and planning the work just like on the backlog the same way you plan feature work is a pretty effective way to do it.
I think we're at time. So I want to say thank you very much, Cindy. That was a great talk.
Thank you.
So let's give Cindy a hand.